Comparison is a natural thing that we as human beings love to do. We look critically at some things and we measure its value, its success, its achievement, or its accomplishments based on certain criteria that we have. And there are times where comparison is absolutely helpful. Where it may be that we're checking out the product and its quality and how it compares to other items, or the work that is being offered by one contractor in comparison to another. But sometimes we measure and compare things, and we don't really know how we ought to compare it. Often, we have a hard time in education systems knowing how we ought to assess and measure. This has been one of the difficulties in the province of Ontario, as the Globe and Mail last summer reported the difficulties of students in grade 6 with their EQAO tests in mathematics, knowing that there has been a significant decline in students' mathematical abilities, but yet not knowing how to assess or compare when different models of education are being used. In an investigation of the curriculum, there have been all sorts of suggestions as to how to improve math among Ontario students. Should it be moving away from problem solving to rote memory and drills? But without having clear standards, it can become difficult to measure effectiveness, quality, and even the goodness of something. Now, when it comes to reverence, human beings are notoriously bad at comparing things. Not that long ago, in fact, I did have a couple share with me how they thought they were doing really well spiritually when they began to assess and compare themselves to other people. But circumstances had changed in their lives, and they were suddenly made aware of the higher standard that God has for them. And so while they had compared themselves to other people, what they had found was that living reverently with lives devoted to God were such that they had a hard time assessing spiritually how their reverence was. When we come to Leviticus 21 and 22, God speaks specifically to Moses and commands him to speak to the sons of Aaron, the priesthood, in chapters 21, verse 1, and 22, verse 2. And God gives special attention to those who function as priests. And there's a good reason. If the priests fail to do their task and to minister it in the right way, it leaves the people and God in a standing where they cannot relate properly to one another. A holy God cannot be misrepresented before his people, and the people depend upon the priests to live holy, reverent lives before the Lord. So in Leviticus 21 and 22, we get really two points that come up here in terms of how we live reverent, holy lives for God. And the first from chapter 21 is that we are to avoid the profane. The fourth commandment that God had given to his people was that they should remember the Sabbath, and in remembering the Sabbath, it was grounded in the third commandment, which was simply this: to not profane the name of the Lord their God. The word profane shows up 13 times in our passage in chapters 21 and 22. And the idea of profaning has the idea of robbing God of glory. Often when we think of the word profane, what we think of is that which is ugly, that which is disgusting, or language that is inappropriate. But when we understand rightly that profaning God's glory is the desecration of his name, then we can understand why it becomes so important. We do still have semblances of understanding why we should not profane things in our culture. Desecrating graves is considered profaning a grave, or mishandling a dead body is considered, even in law, to be that which is profane, which is utterly inappropriate. But in the Israelite world, profaning oneself was profaning the name of God or profaning the sanctuary, and it had the idea of polluting, of contaminating. And to be profane, to be acting in a profane way, was to diminish respect for God, for God's desire was for his people to live not in a nature of profaning his name, not taking his name in vain by their words or by their actions, but by living in such a way that they honored and revered him as God. The way that God's people were to avoid the profane, we see in chapter 21, verses 1 to 9, is the temptation that they faced and needed to resist in terms of comparing their own religious experiences with the experiences of other nations. The Israelites faced this challenge immensely as they came into the land, because as they came into this new land, as they were preparing to come into this new land, there would be a plethora of gods and a plethora of options and of religions, a plurality, if you would, of gods. And confusion by mixing the practices of other religions with the Israelite religion would lead Israel into deep trouble. And we see that throughout the story of the Bible, that God's people end up in enormous, enormous challenges and great problems and huge difficulties because they fail to distinguish their God with the God of the nations. And so God had specifically forbidden his people from mixing religions of the people around them with their worship. And God had given this revelation so that his people would know how they were to worship. Specifically, there are some commands in here that might seem a little odd to us, but the priests were the ones who were to keep their practices in line by having minimal association with the dead because of the nature of how other religions would celebrate the dead or would worship the dead or would practice things that associated with the dead. So, for example, we read throughout these passages of not shaving your head and such strange practices, which suddenly you wonder, is the guy at the front a hypocrite? There are practices of not marking yourselves like with piercings or tattoos, which sometimes people question and wonder when they read these passages, is that appropriate for our day? What about the piercings that go on? What about the tattoos? But specifically, as Deuteronomy 14:1 had pointed out, many of these practices were actually practices that were clearly associated with the worship or the celebration of the dead. And God did not want his people to associate with the worship of the dead. God wanted his people to live as unique, holy people who would celebrate life and not death, which is why Jesus could say that God is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. And as he would rebuke the Pharisees and the Sadducees, his concern was that we would not celebrate and worship death, but because he is a God of life, that we would revere and honor and adore life. So we don't mix ideas of reincarnation and karma or nirvana with the sense of faith that we have, for we understand that the God who is the God of the living, the God who says, I am, not I was, but the God who says, I am the Lord, who is the God of the living, makes it clear to us that in living, he values life, and we ought to worship the God who is the God who gives life. And so the God who raised Jesus from the dead is also the God who will raise each one of us to live this life anew in the body. And by keeping our practices about life and death clear, we remember the seriousness of eternal life. We remember the value of life. And we avoid profaning the worship of our God by not confusing the nature of life and death, by confusing and mixing together the worship of other religions with the worship of the one true living God. And so, just as the priests were to keep themselves in a way morally pure and full of integrity, so they were also to live lives of moral purity and avoid the impurity, as we see in verses 10 through 24. In verses 10 through 15, we actually get very specific commands for the high priest, who had an essential role in going to the inner place to represent Israel before God. And so under no circumstances was he to come into contact with the dead, even if it was a close family member, so as to not contaminate the house of God. In the same way, there were very specific commands about who he could and could not marry. For to marry someone who had been sexually active prior to marriage would bring about moral impurity upon himself and upon his work. And so many of the practices that are forbidden, whether it is cultic or religious or even sexual practices, are defined so that it would be avoided. And if you are familiar with any of the paganism, even of our day, if you've read some of Dan Brown's books, like The Da Vinci Code or such, you will notice intuitively that Dan Brown actually picks up on these pagan foreign concepts that come from 3,000-4,000 years ago of sexual immorality, which are practiced. And so the last set of instructions that come up on moral purity come in verses 16 and following. And they are not primarily about moral purity, but they are about ritual purity. Because the priests, you remember, if they fail to do their job in bringing the sacrifices to God in the proper and right way as God had prescribed, it left the worshiper then in a state of, well, uncertainty with their standing before God. And since God is a God of perfection and holiness, it would be inappropriate for anyone or anything to come before God if there was any sort of physical mutilation, of any sort of physical disorder. And 12 conditions are actually described in our passage in chapter 21, verses 16 to the end of the chapter, which would have prevented someone from have functioned as a priest. Now, we should stop then at this moment and wonder if God says that the lame can't be priests, or the blind, or those who have limbs of different lengths, or so on and so forth. If these people are forbidden from service in the tabernacle, what is the standing of the disabled person who then comes before God? We know in Leviticus 19, verse 14, that God actually demands justice for those who are blind or those who are deaf, that they should not be exploited, treated unfairly, abused, taken advantage of in any way. That in the heart of God, we know that if the law is summed up in love your neighbor as yourself, that God had defended the cause of those who were disadvantaged. If it was physically, emotionally, whatever it was, that God understood that they needed defense and care and not to be exploited. And when we look at the ministry of Jesus, what we find is that when Jesus comes, he is the perfect priest who is not defiled in any way. Perfectly pure, perfectly righteous, perfectly holy, with no contamination. He can go and do the things that no high priest could ever do and touch a dead body and have no contamination from the dead body affect him, but rather his cleanliness be affecting the dead person and raise them to life. He can go and touch the blind and bring sight and cause the lame to walk and cause those who do not see to see and those who do not hear to hear, those who have mouths that cannot speak to speak. He is the God who comes and brings about the nature of the true kingdom, which is life and life to the full. And so Jesus, this perfect priest, obeys the Father, obeys the commands perfectly, which is why Hebrews 5 verse 8 says that although Jesus was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. The standard for Jesus was not the behavior of others around him, but he could say, as he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane in Matthew 26 verse 39, "Not my will, but yours be done." He would be completely obedient to the Father, knowing that the only comparison that mattered was not that his righteousness exceeded that of the Pharisees or of the Sadducees, but that his righteousness was consistent with the standard of God. That was the sole comparison. That was the only comparison that mattered. And since it was not the blood of bulls and goats that makes anyone clean, Jesus could live a perfect life, who is that perfect sacrifice, so that we could have a perfect priest and a perfect sacrifice that would cleanse us from every dead work, so that we might serve the living God regardless of our physical ability, regardless of our physical condition, as Hebrews 9, 13 and 14 says, that the blood of bulls and goats could never fully take away sin, but that sacrifice that came once for all makes us acceptable, that we can go into that holy place. And so in Jesus, the old covenant comes to a fulfillment, a completion, and we have a standard in Jesus that shows us how we ought to live. That we do not profane God's name, that we do not profane his reputation. And it is right then that Christians are expected to live to a higher standard. It's why it's understandable why the culture looks at Christians and can question if they truly are walking in consistency with what they believe. You see, it's more than just us being forgiven. We are righteous people who should strive for holiness. For as Hebrews can say, or Hebrews can say, for without holiness, no one will see the Lord. John can say in 1 John 3 that everyone who has the hope of seeing Christ purifies himself just as he is pure. That it's not the outward effects of the body that God looks upon, but rather the heart. That the heart must be holy. That the heart must be set apart. And so we ought not to mix or confuse our worship of God with the patterns of this world. We ought to live with integrity. We ought to live with purity. We ought to live as those who have been cleansed. And we also ought to advance the holy. So while we don't seek to continue the profane, we avoid the profane. Chapter 22 points out this very clear example of advancing that which is holy. Now, since we're told consistently throughout the Bible to avoid immoral living, we see here that the priests were to practice and advance holiness both in how they functioned and in how they lived. In chapter 22, verses 2 through 9, the priests are actually commanded to be ceremonially clean as they perform their duties, especially as they handle holy things, we see in verse 3, and as they handle the offerings. If their service is not holy, there is a serious penalty. Look at what the penalty was in chapter 22, verse 9. They shall be clean by it. I am the Lord. They shall therefore keep my charge, lest they bear sin for it and die thereby when they profane it. I am the Lord who sanctifies them. The promise was, if you fail to obey, that the punishment for failure to follow God's commands was death. Now, it's very clear that no priest could ever function with perfection, because we see that there's a ritual practice of cleanliness that the priests could have for their own sins. But any willful disobedience and rebellion against God would result in death, as we saw in Nadab and Abihu in chapter 10. That in not practicing God's commands, they put not only themselves, but all of God's people in jeopardy by not mediating the covenant in the right way. So verses 10 through 16 then describe the benefits of the service. That when they offer the sacrifices, there's this blessing that the priests receive, since they function as those who don't receive land like the other tribes. The Levites receive the blessing of the provision of food and care. And so they can take the sacrifice that has been accepted and to focus on the work of the Lord and be dedicated to that task. And as verses 17 through 33 point out, their service was to be costly, offering lambs, bulls, goats, without spot, without blemish, without fault. For God, who is perfect in all of his holiness, ought to be revered by giving, by receiving that which is holy and pure and without spot and without blemish. And since this man who is to come before God is to be the perfect priest, we find in Jesus, as Hebrews 7 says, in Hebrews 7, 26 and 28, that Jesus is our perfect sacrifice and our perfect priest, who is described as holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens, perfect forever. The one who takes away sin and stain and filth, as Hebrews 9:26 says, who appears one time at the end of ages, at the end of the age, for the removal of sin that has been confessed. And so this perfect priest, who is not only the priest, but who is the sacrifice, comes and offers himself on the altar of God so that we might have a sacrifice that exists forever. So that the old covenant, as Hebrews 7 says, it dies away, that it's done away with, that the blood of bulls and goats does not carry on. And so we can come to him with our filth, with our sin, with our moral impurity, with our faults. And we can be cleansed and approach God without guilt or fault or shame, as Hebrews 10 then describes it as coming before God with consciences that are cleansed by the washing of water and having our hearts sprinkled clean. And praise God, that is exactly what Jesus does as our perfect priest and sacrifice, who becomes the standard That we don't compare ourselves to others and we don't say, well, I'm doing better than the rest of the average Christian. Because our standard is not the average other person. Our standard is the perfection and holiness of God who welcomes us and invites us to come, not in our own righteousness, not in comparing ourselves to others, but rather by seeing that when we are forgiven, we are washed clean, that we are made new, that we can come into His presence. And so while the Old Testament defined and spelled out all the details of what reverence and devotion to God looked like, Jesus comes and He personifies it. He walks around and He shows us what holiness looks like. For when Jesus comes, He heals lepers. He raises the dead. He gives sight to the blind. He makes the deaf hear. And He accomplishes that which we could never accomplish. He shows us that holiness is not by, it does not come about by avoiding certain things, as though we can be holy by avoiding certain practices. Rather, in Jesus, we see that it's not avoidance that becomes holy, but rather that God's mission is that holiness become that which is contagious, to use the phrase that the scholar Craig Blomberg uses, that holiness ought to be that which spreads, not uncleanness which spreads. And so the mission of God is for us to revere Him and to be salt and light in this world, as Jesus says in Matthew 5, "You are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world." And by having our hearts changed, when we have been changed, when we have been renewed, it's no blood of bulls or goats that changes us, as Hebrews 9 tells us. But when Jesus comes, the statement that it is the Lord who sanctifies, which is repeated 6 times in these 2 chapters, it is the Lord who sanctifies, it is when we understand that Jesus is our holiness that then we pursue holiness. As Hebrews 10:14 says, "For by a single offering He has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified." That we become holy not by avoiding certain things or trying harder, but by realizing that we who are forgiven, we who have been loved by God, are then placed in a state of holiness, and then out of that state pursue it even more. That it is not by sheer effort alone, but by the grace of God which cleanses us and puts us in right standing. And so, when we interact with people, as we meet people who are lost in the confusion of the plurality of religious ideas of our day, people who are mixed up because of Satan's schemes and devices, we don't have to avoid people. We don't have to be the kind of fundamentalists who are so afraid of contamination that we cut off contact with others, but rather we understand that it is holiness that can be spread to a world where there is darkness. It is light that dispels darkness. And by staying close to Jesus, by confessing our sins, by having our hearts sprinkled clean and our consciences cleansed, we too, like Jesus, can bring life and healing and hope and cleansing to the world, a world full of contamination. Because, you see, it's not merely the priests of Israel who are given this command, for Israel was to be a nation of priests, a kingdom of priests, as Exodus 19, verse 6 says. And Peter, in his first letter in 1 Peter 2, picks up this sense, and he says, "We are God's chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation intended to spread the holiness of God to this world." And we do that as we fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, the one who is our righteousness, the one who is our standard. And as we abide in Him, as we fix our eyes on Him, as we revere Him, we do not let the standard of holiness be that which we compare to other people. That's not our standard. But rather, as we are all called to be priests in this world that needs reconciliation, we speak of Jesus' reconciling work in us and to us, that we might be the agents of change in this world. And what the world needs today, more than anything else, what your workplace needs, what your family needs, what your neighborhood needs, is your personal holiness more than anything else. And so how do we do this? Paul picks up on this idea when we come to the end of his doctrinal section in Romans. And he can say that we ought to offer ourselves afresh to God. That we ought to be the kind of people who are living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God. We who lay down our lives in fresh devotion to God. Since God has done so much for us in Jesus, hear these words again afresh from Paul in Romans chapter 12. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Don't be conformed any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by what? The renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. For this is what the priests of God do, is they become the sacrifices that present themselves afresh to God, living holy lives in comparison to God alone, striving so that we might see Him and know Him, and in doing so, knowing that we might be His agents of spreading holiness to the world. And so that's our prayer, even this day. Lord, make us holy, that we might be the people who bring your holiness to this world, and like Jesus, the touch of healing to a people broken and hurting in sin.